right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. It's time to go ahead and take the gloves off, as Donald Rumsfeld says. Bring back to the show Scott Horton, no relation to myself, just happens to have the exact same name as me. He's a partner with the law firm Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler in New York. He's the president of the International League for Human Rights, is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the New York Bar Association's Committee on International Law, and is an adjunct professor of law at Columbia University. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Horton.
Good to hear from you again. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, sir?
Fine.
I think we should go ahead and stick with our policy from before. I'll be Scott, and you be Mr. Horton, okay?
Sounds a little unfair, but okay.
All right.
You call the rules.
Okay, well, we can both be Scott if you want. I don't care. It's a libertarian show. I let you do what you like.
Does make for a confusing transcript.
Right. Yeah, well, fortunately, I'm way too lazy to transcribe any of these things. MP3 format there. Okay, so let's start with Wilkerson. This is something that was discussed in part with my last couple of guests. Larry Wilkerson, or Lawrence Wilkerson, apparently was Colin Powell's chief of staff for, what, 16 years, and came out last week and gave an absolutely scathing speech to the New America Foundation. Can you tell us a little bit about who this guy is and what was going on there?
Well, he's a career military figure, and it's not only that speech, by the way. He also wrote an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times. It was a real barn burner. But he is as close as you can get to Colin Powell. He worked right at his side, in fact, in an office right next to his, through the greater part of his career. And I think the focus of his remarks is, frankly, he's speaking with the voice of Colin Powell. I mean, Powell has distanced himself a bit from Wilkerson, but there's just no question that he's expressing Powell's views, and he's expressing resentment over having been tricked or deceived. Who did this? It's people at the CIA who did it, but I think, you know, now we're seeing increasingly evidence that it's people out of the Office of Special Plans at the Pentagon and Vice President Cheney's office who were involved.
So we really are seeing what Bob Dreyfus, one of my last guests, described as sort of an alliance coming together between basically everybody who's not a neocon versus the neocons at this point, right?
I think that's right. I would say the pragmatic, traditional conservatives, and in this case also very much the old line flag officer leadership from the Pentagon, the retired officers.
Right. And in fact, I should say it's about time we started hearing from them. I know that generals were resigning in record numbers in the lead up to war, but it never really got much publicity except, you know, General Zinni here and there.
I think that's right. But, you know, we have a poll that appears this morning in the Charlotte Observer in North Carolina saying that 56% of all military in North Carolina are unhappy with President Bush's leadership of the military. Now, I can't recall anything like that having happened before. That's and that reflects the level of upset we see across the military.
Well, and also we got to keep in mind, too, about soldiers in uniform, that besides, you know, what they have to answer the way they have to answer, because you can get in trouble for talking bad about the commander in chief and that kind of thing. But people in the military, more than anybody else, really convince themselves that whatever they're doing is right, whatever the politicians tell them to do must be right, because it's not their job to question the politics. Their job is to be the Army, and that's what they do. So it's really hard, I've found, for the average soldier to even admit to himself he's got a problem at all. To see 56% in outright dissent in North Carolina, that's a pretty big deal. I think we all better take note.
Yeah, I think it's unprecedented.
All right, my friends, I'm Scott Horton, and I'm interviewing Scott Horton. We'll be right back. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Scott Horton, no relation. He's a lawyer from New York City. He's the president of the International League for Human Rights, and is an adjunct professor of law at Columbia University. No confusing him with me other than the name there. So let's talk about some good news in the torture news, which that's really what you're about, is explaining to the rest of us what's going on inside the military and the CIA when it comes to the administration's torture policies. And there is good news. John McCain, on his second or third attempt, was able to get a torture ban amendment through the Senate by a vote of 90-9. And always thinking ahead, that John McCain, he attached it to a $450 billion defense spending measure. And last I heard, I guess Bush was threatening to veto it, but after the indictment that came down yesterday, I don't think he'll be able to veto this bill, will he, Scott?
Well, that's still the threat that's hanging out there. I mean, we still have to get this bill enacted completely into law. So having 90 votes in the Senate is a strong first move, but we've got to get it through the House in a parallel measure, or we have to get the conference committee between the House and the Senate to accept it on this bill. And on that point, we know that Vice President Cheney is in the trenches working almost nonstop on this matter. He's been lining up votes in the conference against it. He's had two meetings with Senator McCain, basically stating his objections and proposing changes to the McCain Amendment, which would effectively gut it. And I guess being very realistic about where things stand right now, I would say the GOP leadership will be able to stop this measure in the conference committee. So I'm not optimistic. I think when we finally get to a full vote in the House, we have a majority of the votes in the House in support of this measure, and we will ultimately get it enacted. But it may be a matter of several more months.
Well, it's amazing to think that Dick Cheney has time and to spend in this last week harassing the Senate for trying to outlaw torture. Isn't he basically an unindicted co-conspirator here?
Well, in fact, everyone was speculating over how his name would appear in the indictment, and his name appears as Vice President Cheney. I mean, a lot of people thought he would be an unindicted co-conspirator, but I think if you look at the indictment, he has an absolutely focal role in that indictment. In fact, tomorrow's New York Times is going to have a big article talking about that, about the fact that now Vice President Cheney is dead center in the middle of this investigation. It's already been posted on their website.
Yeah, well, that's good news, and it's hard to avoid the conclusion when you read the indictment. I remember there's one part particularly where they talk about, well, they were all on the airplane together, and Scooter Libby had a meeting with Dick Cheney and all of his principals, and then when they landed, he got a call from Matthew Cooper and discussed the Valerie Plame name with Matthew Cooper right after having a meeting all about what to do about this with Dick Cheney.
And
it's basically right there in the indictment.
That's exactly right. And, of course, Scooter Libby was always referred to as Dick Cheney's Dick Cheney, basically the vice president's alter ego. And it's impossible to think that he did the things he did without full sanction and, in fact, direction from Dick Cheney. So, you know, what's going on right now is that it may be that Scooter Libby's the man who's taking the bullet, but he's taking the bullet for Dick Cheney.
Well, and we'll see. He's facing enough jail time that maybe they can get him to flip. Although, I guess my understanding is he tried to flip, and Fitzgerald said, yeah, I already have those notes. Thanks anyway.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think the prosecutor said that the investigation is not concluded. He still has a ways to go. I mean, it's unclear how this will wind up at the end. I think it's quite clear that there are going to be further indictments before it's wrapped up.
Well, I sure hope you're right about that. It seemed like Fitzgerald was doing his best to dissuade us from believing so in his press conference yesterday. But, you know, as actually we just went over this in the last hour, all the major crimes of the Bush administration are all connected. It's all, whether it's Valerie Plame or Ahmed Chalabi or the Office of Special Plans working with Ariel Sharon's office to lie us into war, Larry Franklin and the rest of this, it's all tied together in one big scandal. So as long as there's a grand jury impaneled, there's hope that it will run away, I suppose.
Well, I think you're right that it does, that all these things do tie back to the effort to take the country to war in Iraq. In fact, almost all of these scandals flow out of that.
Okay, now let's get back to Cheney and what exactly it was he was doing last week, besides worrying about being named as an unindicted co-conspirator or an indicted one. You say he was busy harassing John McCain and making visits on Capitol Hill trying to get them to take out the torture ban. Now, is that entirely, or I think I read in the Post that he just wanted to exempt the CIA. The Army can't torture people anymore, but the CIA still can, is what he's pushing for, right?
That's exactly right. He proposes this as a compromise. He says, I'll take the military off the hook. They won't be involved in the torture process anymore, but we want to have the flexibility to authorize the CIA to do this. Now, of course, when this was discussed on the floor of the Senate back on October 6th, that was the focal question. Should any branch of the U.S. service be permitted to use torture? And I think there was a very firm decision, an unequivocal decision, that no, there has to be an absolute bright line against it. And in fact, both Lindsey Graham and John McCain made a very clear point. If we look at all these cases of abuse, Abu Ghraib, and the recent things involving Captain Ian Fishback, for instance, in almost every one of these cases, it starts with the CIA. I mean, there are CIA investigators there using these techniques, and then you see young military people thinking, well, this is how we do it, and picking it up. So it really is a sort of cancer that can't be checked once it's introduced. The prohibition has to be an absolute one.
Well, and you know, in that Washington Post article, there's a quote from a guy from Human Rights Watch who says that the argument of the administration has been, well, look, there's no law that forbids it, because, of course, they did a finding and made a determination that the law doesn't apply. So I guess that's their argument there. But this guy from Human Rights Watch is saying if McCain and the Congress give in to Dick Cheney on this, this will be the first time in American law that it is specifically allowed, that you may not forbid torture because it's allowed right here in black and white.
That's exactly right. That was Tom Malinowski who said that. And, you know, he made that point. The Washington Post also ran an editorial in which they called Cheney vice president for torture, saying that in American history, from the founding of our republic, no political leader has ever publicly and directly advocated the use of torture before Dick Cheney in the last couple of weeks. It's a shocking development.
It's absolutely it makes me wonder whether maybe they're talking to so few people now because they're all under a criminal investigation that there's just nobody to say, hey, wait a minute, are you sure that's a good idea?
Or they're very concerned about having explicit authorization for things that they've done. I mean, I think it's telling that back on October 6th, we had senator after senator going to the well of the Senate saying, we're not enacting a new law here. We're making clear what has always been the law, that this is not permitted. Now, of course, Dick Cheney and his lawyer, David Abington, are the people who pushed through these new torture practices. And if it turns out all of this is unlawful and it has occurred at their initiative, we've got a whole other area of liability for them.
Now, David Abington, where have I heard that name in the last couple of days, Scott?
Well, David Abington is going to succeed Scooter Libby as his chief of staff.
Yes, Slate magazine calls him the torture lawyer.
That's exactly right. I think when we study, you know, the source of these torture documents, you know, probably John Yoo's name comes up a lot, Al Gonzalez's name, Jay Bybee. But if we had to pick just one lawyer who's really responsible for this, his name is definitely David S. Abington.
Oh, well, no wonder he got a promotion.
That's right. I would say he and Dick Cheney are a very well-matched pair.
And now that Harriet Myers is out of the way, maybe we can get Alberto Gonzalez on the Supreme Court.
There are a lot of people expecting that he may very well be the nominee, but I guess I think that's unlikely.
Well, you have to wonder. Really, it's sort of like they're just going for the gold now. They don't care whether we all have their name and number. They don't care whether Brent Scowcroft and Larry Wilkerson are coming out explaining what's going on. They don't care if indictments are coming down the pike. They're just going to go ahead and do what they're going to do and, I guess, push us down and say, what are you going to do about it, basically.
But their problem is really with Republican leadership, because you know, we have a group, and I think, you know, the vote on October 6th again shows it very clearly, because we had 46 Republican senators with us on the torture issue, only 9 on the other side. I mean, so we got the overwhelming majority of the Republicans in the Senate, and we'll do more or less the same in the House. And I would say of those 46 Republican senators, we've got roughly 20 of them who are very concerned about the way this administration is handling national security issues, about the way the military is being run, and who urgently want to see some shift. It's not really possible for them to push through any policies with that sort of fragmentation in the Republican ranks. So they've got to do something that's going to assuage this division.
And as you said in the first segment there, there are a lot of professional military guys, current and retired flag officers, who are involved in this push, too. You told Amy Goodman earlier this week that I believe 40 different flag officers in league with Colin Powell helped push those 46 Republican senators to John McCain's side on this vote in the Senate, right?
That's exactly right. And I'd say 40, and most of them have been very actively engaged on this, working and lobbying people in the House and in the Senate directly. And I think that's what produced this groundswell and got us to 90 votes in the Senate, and we'll do the same in the House.
And, you know, the last time we talked, you said if you drew up a chart of who all was for the torture policy and who was against it, it was all the people who had served in uniform in their life opposed it. And the rest of the neocons who all dodged the draft were all the ones saying, yeah, go ahead and torture them.
That's exactly right, and that's still the case. And that's also the dividing line in the Senate. People who had served previously in uniform really didn't have to spend any time thinking through this issue. It was clear for them.
All right, everybody. We're talking with Scott Horton from the International League for Human Rights. We'll be right back. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com, and I'm talking with Scott Horton, the International League, from the International League for Human Rights. No relation to myself, unless maybe we go way, way, way back.
Many generations of that.
Right. You can find what Scott Horton has been writing lately at the Balkanization blog. It's balkin.blogspot.com, and he's got a lot of really great blog entries there concerning torture. And one of those, I was reminded a few moments ago when you mentioned that Dick Cheney is the first politician in American history to openly call for torturing people in this way. And on one of your blog in one of your blog entries on balkin.blogspot.com, you talk about George Washington and what his policy was for how the Continentals were to treat prisoners of war during the American Revolution. And I thought, you know what, that's really worth bringing up on the show today for people to kind of get the contrast of how far we've come in 235 years.
Well, that's right. I think this is before the United States was established as a country during the Revolutionary War. And if we go back then to 1776, 1775, that war was a nasty one from the United States perspective. A lot of Americans were taken prisoner earlier in the war. 1775, we had roughly 30 Americans taken prisoner at Bunker Hill. In March of 1776, we had more than 2,000 Americans taken prisoner at the capitulation of Fort Washington. Almost all those Americans were killed, and they were killed after being brutally mistreated and tortured in most cases. And that's because the British viewed the Americans not as soldiers fighting a lawful war, but as insurgents.
Enemy combatants. Right.
Exactly right. With no rights and no protections. And Washington was under a lot of pressure at that time to do the same thing to the British when they were captured. And the first real success we had in battle was the Battle of Trenton. That was on Christmas Eve of 1776, when a garrison with a couple of Hessian mercenary units were captured. And there was a proposal that these units should be forced to run the gauntlet, which is to say physically beaten. And Washington said, no, we are not going to do that. And he issued a very famous order that began, above all, treat them with humanity. And he went on to lay out very specific standards for how prisoners were to be treated. And he said, the bottom line is that we will treat them just the same way our own soldiers are treated. They will have the same accommodations, the same food, the same medical treatment. Under no circumstances will they be beaten or mistreated in any way. He was extremely firm about this. And we know there were a couple of cases when Washington meted out very severe corporal punishment, including floggings. prisoners. And one of the most famous cases, in fact, involves a soldier who was caught abusing detainees. He wanted to make an example of this man and had him flogged. So Washington had very, very strong feelings about this. And he used it as a moral example for the United States to show that we held ourselves to a higher standard than the Brits did. It was very effective by the end of the war. It was also very effective in moving public opinion in Britain against George III and the war he was waging.
I was just going to say, I wonder whether his generals ever paused to reflect that they were creating more revolutionaries going around mistreating people.
That's exactly right. I mean, it did stir up sentiment. It made it fiercer and stronger, and it really helped the Americans deal with the royalists. I mean, you know, New York, for instance, where I live, at the beginning of the Revolutionary War, was largely in the royalist camp, and after 1777, it switched and really came to side with the revolutionaries.
I hope you forgive me if I take this analogy to Iraq. It seems that this very same schizophrenic policy, on one hand, we're trying to win you over and win your hearts and minds and keep you loyal to the crown. And on the other hand, we will savagely torture you and beat you and humiliate you and degrade you in every way if you even think about challenging us.
Well, in fact, General Joseph Hoar recently gave an interview in which he made exactly that point. He said that he read McCullough's recent book about 1776, and he said he couldn't help but come away with the impression that this was Iraq, except we're the redcoats now. The parallels are very, very strong ones. Another point we should raise about Washington, he was also really concerned about respecting the religious views of your adversary. He said you never use religion as a tool or weapon against your adversary. You always demonstrate that you respect their religious values. He made that a primary concern and constantly gave orders to that effect. And that was policy of the U.S. military from 1776 when he first issued those orders until 2002. And then something very dramatic happened. I mean, this is another area where military leaders in the United States are now very angry with the changes that have been introduced in Washington that have come from the Bush administration.
And you've also written on that Balkan.blogspot.com blog extensively, and I'll ask you about this when we come back from this break, about various generals who have stood up to Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and have found themselves smeared and driven right out of the army. I'm talking with Scott Horton. He's the president of the International League for Human Rights, and we'll be right back after this.
Don't take your guns to town.
All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Scott Horton. He's the president of the International League for Human Rights, and lately he's been writing some incredible blog entries at balkan.blogspot.com. That's balkin.blogspot.com. And one of the things that you wrote on there that I was reading in the past couple of days, Scott, was about this guy, James Yee, who was, I believe, a chaplain at Guantanamo Bay. Can you tell us this guy's story?
That's right. He was assigned as he's a West Point graduate, career U.S. Army officer. He was assigned as the Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo. And while there, just attending to his normal duties, he found himself one day suddenly arrested and put in solitary confinement, in fact, for a period of 60 days. He was accused of treason and all sorts of other high crimes, was treated abysmally. His own family was told nothing about him. Efforts were made to break his wife and to get him to give evidence against Captain Yee. And in the end, it turned out that all these accusations were completely baseless, without any foundation whatsoever. And then they brought charges against him to the effect that he had had an affair with a woman on Guantanamo. And they started putting this out in the press all over the place. And they used this as the basis for disciplining him.
And this guy, they basically treated him just like any other inmate of Guantanamo, the fact that he was a West Point graduate notwithstanding.
Exactly right. He found himself being treated just as if he was one of the Guantanamo Al-Qaeda inmates.
Well, you have a different looking face and a different sounding religion, and that's the end of your natural right to life and liberty, right?
Well, that's certainly what the case suggests. He's got a book out right now that that tells his entire tale. It's a fascinating read.
And also in that same blog entry, you talk about Major General Fiscus, Lieutenant General John Riggs, and General Kevin Burns. All three of them, you say, were run out of the military for opposing Rumsfeld. And interestingly, all of them run out on charges, like Mr. Yee, of sexual impropriety, when what they're opposing is this sexual torture of people.
That's exactly right. I mean, we're finding that under Donald Rumsfeld, this is a favored technique. If somebody crosses him, he will bring them up on charges of having improper sexual relations. Now, you know, to us, generally, improper sexual relations mean somebody's abused their authority, you know, or it's been rape or something of that sort. In the military, that's not what it means. Anytime two consenting adults have sexual relationship outside of marriage, that's improper and you can be punished for it. So this is the way he's using that, very manipulatively. And we really find these charges being brought over and over and over again, only in cases where someone has run up against the Pentagon on some important policy issue, and most frequently it's been over this torture issue.
And I think I honestly had never heard of Fiscus or Riggs before, but I remember the story of this guy, Kevin Burns, getting forced out, and I think everybody was wondering what was the real reason that he was forced out, and you're saying he had butted heads with Rumsfeld over torture policy, right?
All these officers are very, very discreet, and they really haven't gone running to the press to talk about things. But we know that General Kevin Burns was in charge of doctrine and that he was given the specific responsibility of rewriting Field Manual 3452, which is the interrogations manual. We know that Rumsfeld was pushing very aggressively to have highly coercive techniques, what some people will certainly call torture, included into this manual. And we know from a number of sources that General Burns just wasn't going to have any of this. He was resisting it, although quietly. And all of a sudden an investigation starts, and he's found to be having a liaison with a woman. Well, General Burns was at that point in the process of getting divorced from his wife, and for all I know was going to marry this new woman. So this was used as a pretext to discipline him and railroad him out of the office, out of the Army. With Major General Fiscus, who was the Judge Advocate General of the Air Force, more or less the same show. I mean, we know that General Fiscus was one of the JAG officers who raised very strong objection to attempts to introduce torture, and shortly after that, there's an investigation started into him. There are wiretaps placed in his phone. Someone starts looking through his emails, and then he's also accused of having improper sexual liaison.
Is he one of the JAGs that came to you at the New York bar?
Well, I'm not going to say who came to me at the New York bar, but, you know, clearly he was one of the leadership figures in the JAG Corps.
Okay, now for people who don't understand, the JAG Corps, they're the military lawyers, and if I understand what you explained to me last time correctly, basically what happened was these guys were frozen out of the interrogation techniques, and they were afraid that they were going to get the blame for what all was going on, that it was their job to stop, but they weren't in any position to stop it, so they came to you, right?
I think that's part of the story is they were concerned about being circumvented, but another part of it was, ultimately proposals came to them out of Guantanamo to introduce these new techniques, and they were horrified by that, and they raised objection to it very loudly. And, of course, since the time you and I spoke the first time, Lindsey Graham and Senators Warner and McCain succeeded in getting a whole slew of papers out of the Pentagon. And we now know, and a lot of these papers have now been published, showing how the Judge Advocate General of all the service areas, you know, Marine Corps, Navy, Army, Air Force, every one of them objected on the strongest terms to what happened. And moreover, they said, if you do this, things will happen that will be humiliating to the United States and will demoralize our armed forces. And in fact, of course, what's happened is exactly what they said was going to happen.
Right. And, you know, you talked before about the religious abuse. George Washington's better not number one, I guess, on his list. No, number one. how this is exactly what we're doing now is abusing the Quran. There's such a big flack. How dare Newsweek say that they urinated on it? All they did was just throw it in a puddle of urine on the floor. And there's a really big difference there. They better retract that story. And you've written wrapping these guys in Israeli flags, forcing them to eat pork and that kind of thing.
Absolutely right. I mean, we know now repeatedly from many people who are involved in formation of these new techniques that they consciously use the religious values of the detainees as a basis to humiliate and degrade them. So it's exactly what George Washington ordered must never be done on pain of the most serious punishment is now being done as a matter of doctrine.
Well, and for people who, and listen, I don't mean to be too patronizing here, but the fact is, Scott, that many people in this country believe that if you live across water from here, you're not a human and you don't have rights, and we're not supposed to care about what happens to someone if they're from some other country. They're not Americans like us. And so then it's strictly a pragmatic question to them of whether this is the right thing to do or not. And as discussed when we were talking about the American Revolution, this just made it harder and harder for the British to put down the American Revolution. And just last week, I interviewed Michael Scheuer from the CIA again, a former CIA operative who maintains that America is bin Laden's indispensable ally. And I just want people to ask themselves, what do you think happens when a detainee, whatever he used to be, when a detainee is tortured and wrapped in an Israeli flag and then set free? What do you think he tells people when he gets home? Think they don't know about this?
And what do you think his family thinks? I mean, in both Afghanistan and Iraq, I mean, we've had studies done in the last few months that show that public opinion, which at the beginning of the conflict had a very positive view of the United States and the United States soldiers, is now turning very strongly against us. And the principal factor that's turning the public against the United States and making the situation much more dangerous for our men and women in uniform are these antics. It's acting against the religious values of these prisoners, showing disrespect for Islam. This infuriates the people there.
Well, I think, Scott, probably what you need to do is just go to a Karen Hughes seminar and find out that, the problem is that they just have, the administration's having a problem with PR right now. And that if you could just hear Karen Hughes explain to you how this is really all for everybody's own good, then you'd probably accept her argument, right?
Oh, yep. Karen Hughes is a big part of the problem, of course. She was out there making gross misstatements about the U.S. tradition. She told an audience in Saudi Arabia that our Constitution begins one nation under God, which suggests to me that Karen Hughes has probably never read the Constitution. And I was told by a diplomatic person out in the Middle East that after her visit, an order was issued by the embassy in Saudi Arabia to its personnel asking everyone to please read the Constitution.
Well, and the idea that, what she really needs to get across to these people is, hey, we're not all a bunch of Britney Spearses. We're all deeply, deeply religious, too. We believe in our religion just as deeply as you do, as though that's what they really need to hear, is that what mostly is motivating American foreign policy is the Christian religion. That's really going to smooth things over there.
Well, to a certain extent, it does work, though. I mean, I think, people in the Middle East are largely are people of faith, and I think they view those who have strong religious values more positively than those who are purely secular. But I think, as you point out, it's a double-edged sword. You've got to be very careful about it. And what reflects the values of our nation? I mean, our nation is a secular nation. In fact, that's our Constitution. And it's very dangerous for U.S. political figures to be running around the world espousing a particular religious value. That's not the basis on which our country was founded.
Especially when supposedly we're reordering the Middle East in order to create secular modern societies.
No, and using words like crusades and crusaders, which of course are extremely emotional, provocative terms in the Middle East.
Okay, now on the tactics here, especially in terms of the sexual humiliation of these prisoners, I've read a couple of times references to a book called The Arab Mind.
Yes.
That supposedly is this great inspiration to these torturers, that now they know how to interrogate them properly.
Well, that's true. I mean, we know that photographed copies of that book were circulated amongst people who were involved in designing new techniques. And that book was written by a Rutgers University anthropologist whose work is, frankly, not held in high regard by other anthropologists today. It's viewed as primitive, simplistic, and in particular, irrelevant to the situation in Iraq, because that book is talking about nomadic Arabs from places like Saudi Arabia, whereas Iraq is a highly urban, sophisticated culture with a high level of literacy. It's really a different culture from the one described in that book.
Was I wrong to expect that more footage and photographs from Abu Ghraib would be released by now?
Well, they would have been released, but for vociferous opposition that's come from the administration. An order was issued for their release. The administration didn't release them. It then sought a rehearing before the judge, submitted some very dramatic affidavits, including one by Dick Myers, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, in which he said that if the judge issues this order, he's going to undermine the security of soldiers throughout this conflict. And the judge, I think, was a very brave man, ruled that the law on this issue was clear. In fact, the government hardly even made any arguments based on the law. They pretty much acknowledged that the law required turning these materials over with some modifications. So the judge ruled in accordance with the law, and it's now going to go up on appeal, I think. That would be my supposition. I think the materials are going to come out eventually, but I'm not sure when. And I know what the government's doing now is they're trying to block these materials from coming out while the McCain Amendment, seeking to ban torture is going on in the Congress, because I think they're concerned about not really about what consequences they'll have in Iraq and Afghanistan, where this is nothing new. This is what people there already know. They're concerned about the domestic political ramifications of publication of these photos.
Well, and they probably are correct that there would be all new uprisings wherever there are American troops stationed in the Middle East after something like this. Everything that I've read about this information, I know some senators have gotten to take a look at it and said it's far worse than anything we've seen from Abu Ghraib so far. Have you gotten a chance to see this stuff yourself?
I've had some of it described to me, and I think those descriptions are right. I mean, what is in some of these pictures and some of the videotapes is worse than what we've seen so far. It's simply sickening. It shows really depraved conduct going on with American prison guards and American officers standing by and doing nothing about it.
And, you know, you brought up earlier in the hour about how this is not just Abu Ghraib. This is widespread all over Iraq, at least. And really, we know now in ghost prisons that they have on ships and in the stands in Central Asia and in Jordan, I believe, is where they're holding Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They said they have these ghost prisons. You've written about torture at Camp Mercury. And there was a documentary that came out just last week on Frontline called The Torture Question, where they interviewed, I forget the young man's name now, but basically quite a few different people came forward to admit the role that they had played in torturing people. And this one guy particularly came out, admitted his name, and let them photograph his face, and said that this kind of stuff happens all over Iraq all the time. And more to the point, or back to your original point, that it was the CIA guys who started it. It was civilians and mercenaries who came in there with no uniforms and said, all right, this is what we want you to do and how to do it.
That's right. I mean, we had four soldiers in that front line. I helped work with the directors of the front line program in putting that together. I mean, we had two soldiers who appeared in shadow box and two who were on camera talking about this. That was completely new in new cases. And if you went and looked at the front line reader comment box afterwards, you'll see there were several pages of comments that were submitted by soldiers in the field in Iraq. And they were almost all the same thing, which was saying, you know, we see your description, this was a fair program, and we're all prepared to say this is what's going on, even in our units, even right now.
Wow.
So this is really is all over, and it reflects policies that were put in place at the top by the Pentagon with the support, actually with the urging of Vice President Cheney. And this, I think, makes clear why it is we have to have this measure by Senator McCain.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I want to bring up here real quick before this last break is the dehumanization in there. I saw where you wrote that the person under control is referred to as a puck. And so therefore, they're not humans anymore. It's just as good as gook or kraut or whatever dehumanizing term that soldiers use to deprive their enemies of their rights. Oh, you're a puck. I'm going to go smoke a puck. I'm going to go beat a puck. And it's just these people aren't human beings anymore. They're pucks.
That's exactly right, and this is a process we see on Fox News every evening, frankly. Every army has to use demonization to help motivate soldiers. You can't get around that. It's just a fact of life. But woe to any country when you allow yourself to be taken over by this demonization process. It leads to ruin and devastation, and this is what we're seeing right now.
All right, everybody. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Scott Horton. We'll be right back to wrap up. All right, my friends, welcome back. Wrapping up the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. Keep all the archives at weekendinterviewshow.com in MP3 format for you. And also, you can donate to me there at weekendinterviewshow.com. Wrapping up an interview with the guy with the very same name as me, Scott Horton. He is the president of the International League for Human Rights, is a partner in the law firm Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler in New York, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the New York Bar Association's Committee on International Law, and is an adjunct professor at Columbia University. And you can find what he writes, lately anyway, at balkan.blogspot.com. That's not Balkan like Central Europe. That's somebody's last name, balkin.blogspot.com. And Scott Horton has got some incredible entries on there. In the last few minutes here, I was wondering if we could talk about the hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay. I read a report, I guess a week ago, that said they've got these people on feeding tubes. They're forcing them to stay alive, these people who want to die.
That's right. I mean, the worst of it is not so much the IV treatments. It's the use of forced feeding through tubes in the throat, which has been done, according to a number of witnesses, in a very, very brutal fashion. Designed effectively to punish those who are engaged in this hunger strike.
How many people have committed suicide at Guantanamo so far, do you know?
Well, I don't have the exact number of suicides. I know the total number of deaths in detention right now is about 108. And of those deaths in detention, we've got information suggesting that 21 approximately seem to have a direct relationship with the interrogation process.
And I think, wasn't that the number that just came out in the last week, 21 deaths in custody?
21 deaths related to interrogation in custody. Mm-hmm. And I think we got a good number of those where we can say with some certainty that the people were tortured to death.
What do you know about...
And no prosecutions coming out of any of those cases, by the way, not one.
Well, is anybody except you pushing this issue? I mean, John McCain's a senator, and, you know, I'm not a particularly big fan of his for other reasons. Obviously, I'm with him on this, but he can't appoint a prosecutor. I mean, who's doing anything about this, Scott?
Well, the bar associations have raised the question. A number of people have so far. Lindsey Graham, I think, has been very, very good raising the question about this. Senator Levin from Michigan has. So we've got a lot of people in Congress asking questions and pushing. But in fact, this shows our criminal justice system simply not functioning. And there's a good reason why, because we know, particularly with the CIA personnel, a lot of these cases involve CIA, that if the CIA personnel are accused, if charges brought against them, they're going to say, well, we did what we were authorized to do. And there are these Department of Justice memoranda out there that authorize the torture. So for anybody at the Department of Justice, it raises the specter immediately of embarrassment and raises questions about the people who issued those memoranda. And that includes, of course, the Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez.
Right. So if you're a federal prosecutor who wants to do your job, you can just reflect on the fact that you're going to lose your job if you try, so why even bother, right?
That's exactly right, which is the reason why this thing could only be handled through a special counsel, just like we have now with Patrick Fitzgerald. I mean, it should be a person who is independent, who exercises independent judgment, and can take the matter where it wherever it goes.
Okay, now you're sure that Lindy England didn't mastermind this whole thing. This is Dick Cheney's responsibility?
I think if I follow it up to the top of the ladder, I see Dick Cheney sitting at the top.
All right, everybody. Scott Horton, he is the president of the International League for Human Rights, and you can read what he writes at balkin.blogspot.com, balkin.blogspot.com. Thank you so much for your time today, Mr. Horton.
All the best to you. Take care.
All right. All right, everybody, weekendinterviewshow.com, antiwar.com, and we'll be back next week.